A powerful song, and that's kind of the rub, right? Is the teach us your ways. Do we want to follow the ways of Jesus or not? Part of us being followers of Jesus, part of us submitting to a king, being allegiant to a king, is to say that your ways are going to become my ways. I'm going to go the way that you're going. And that's the challenge for us, and we've been kind of exploring that in the midst of the sermon series that we're in. Well, good morning, friends. Thanks for coming out in the snow, you hearty New Englanders. I was a little taken aback by the snow this morning, but it actually helps me a little bit with the question that I'm going to ask of all of us this morning, which is not so much a spiritual question, at least on the surface. It's more of a meteorological question, which is who makes it rain? Or what makes it rain? Or where does the rain come from, right? Or the snow in an instance like this. That may seem like kind of an antiquated question. What do you mean, where does the rain come from? What do you mean, who makes it rain? Well, some of us may say nobody makes it rain. It just rains or it doesn't rain. A meteorologist might even be able to uncover for us all of the various factors that lead to precipitation falling from the sky, but there's more to the question that meets the eye, isn't there? Right? Because rain isn't just a meteorological event, right, that happens with some frequency in some places and maybe little to no frequency in other places. Rain is life, because water is life. There's a secular creed that maybe some of you have seen in front of your neighbor's homes, or maybe even in front of your own home, and one of the key phrases that's on that sign is the phrase "water is life," right? And a lot of us probably agree with that. Rain is more than just the combined outcome of low barometric pressure and water condensation in the atmosphere. Rain has existential gravitas. If there is no rain, then there are no crops for livestock to eat. So there's no Five Guys for us to enjoy, right? But that's not the least of our problems, is it? If there's no rain, there's no crops for us to eat. And that's still not the biggest problem. If there's no rain, there's no water for us to drink. And long before we ever die from lack of little cheeseburgers, we die from dehydration. Right? At no time in my life has this been more apparent to me than in the past few years as our youngest son, Aiden, has been growing up. Aiden has a strange, rare condition called cyclical vomiting syndrome. It sounds lovely, doesn't it? Right? Without getting into the gory details, basically, without provocation, the poor kid starts vomiting every hour or more with no ability to stop. We never know when this is going to happen. It doesn't happen all the time. Maybe happens a few times a year, but we're never quite sure. Now, beyond the obvious cleanup challenges that this presents is really the life and death reality caused by him not being able to keep water in his body. So if the medicine that he has doesn't work to stop the vomiting, within a few hours, he becomes dehydrated, and within hours after that, he begins to starve. And so he requires an IV treatments at the hospital to break the cycle and bring his nutrition and hydration back to a safe level. And Kathleen, my wife, has watched what seems like countless times now the nurses give him that IV of water and other good stuff that truly is a lifeline for him that brings him back to health. Water is life. And we probably don't think about it enough, especially in a developed world with clean running water at our fingertips. But that was not the case in the ancient world. In the ancient world, there was much more of an intimate, day-by-day relationship with the fundamental need for water. People would look up at the sky, they'd see the clouds, they would experience the weather, and they would ask the same question that I asked just a few moments ago: where does the rain come from? Who sends the rain? And in the ancient Near Eastern world, the answer to that question was more often than not, well, rain comes from Baal. Baal was an ancient god of rain and fertility. Ancient texts called him the charioteer of the clouds. He rides on the clouds and brings the reign. So this belief about Baal and the worship of Baal was everywhere in the ancient Near Eastern world, which is one of the reasons why, as you read through the Old Testament, you see God, and I'll refer to God often this morning as Yahweh, that's the name of God, as to distinguish him from the other god with the name Baal. Okay? So this is one of the reasons why you see in the Old Testament Yahweh, the God of the Israelites, going to great lengths to protect his people from the worship of Baal. Forbidding them to eat pork is an example of this. Pig slaughter and sacrifice was a part of Baal worship. So as a mark of purification, of separation from the Baal worshipers, God gave them dietary restrictions. But at the heart of Baal worship was this very human, very existential question, where does the rain come from? In other words, who allows us to survive and to thrive in this world where we have to have water? And while the worship of Baal was all around them in the ancient world, the Israelites were actually meant to be very different. They had a God who actually came and didn't just supply them with their needs, but who showed them how to live their lives. The other gods did not do this. So they didn't worship the idol god Baal. They worshiped the true God, the maker of heaven and earth named Yahweh. And perhaps in an effort to clarify that it was not Baal who was the bringer of rain, it was not Baal who was the charioteer of the clouds, that's what they called him in the ancient world, the charioteer of the clouds. We see texts throughout the Old Testament saying the opposite, using that same language to describe Yahweh. Deuteronomy chapter 33 says, "Who rides across the heavens to help you and on the clouds in his majesty?" Rides on the clouds, okay? This is like language that was used for Baal, and now it's being taken to talk about Yahweh, because Yahweh is the true God. He is the charioteer of the clouds. Psalm 104, "The Lord makes the clouds his chariot and rides on the wings of the wind." God was communicating to his people, Baal is not the charioteer of the clouds. I am the charioteer of the clouds. And this was the fundamental worship choice that they had when they considered the question, who sustains my life? Where does the rain come from? Baal or Yahweh? Okay. All of which begs a different question. How, in the ancient world at least, how does one choose a god? If in the ancient world they had multiple gods to choose from, how did they choose who their god was going to be? Now, I'm going to pause here for a moment. At this point, maybe some of you are asking, like, okay, this is very interesting historical information. What does this have to do with my life? Thanks, Pastor. And what I want to do today is bring this ancient world stuff a bit closer to our reality for today. Because just like they were human, we are human today. And I don't want to divorce our experiences in the world today from the experiences of these people so long ago, because there's so much overlap that we so often miss. For the past several weeks, we've been looking at the kings of Israel, and in many instances, what we've been seeing is how our lives today actually mirror the lives of these kings of Israel. We may not be kings and queens over an ancient nation, but we are kings and queens over our own lives in a world today that pretty much hands us remarkable individualism and self-autonomy. And so, like them, our tendency is to forget that there's actually another king. We may be the kings and queens of our own lives, but there's another king, Yahweh, the king of all kings, to whom we may or may not give our allegiance in our life. So in keeping with that narrative, I'm going to ask the question again. How did ancient people choose their gods? Well, for starters, the answer is that the people largely didn't choose their gods, but the kings did. And over again, one of the commonly recurring phrases in the books of 1 and 2 Kings is this phrase that the king anytime a new king is introduced, the king either, it says, did evil in the eyes of the Lord, or the king did right in the eyes of the Lord. And what that essentially means is that the king either followed Yahweh, submitted to Yahweh, followed the ways of Yahweh, like we were just singing about, teach us your ways. Well, there were kings who wanted to know the ways of Jesus, of the Lord. And then there were other kings who followed other gods, who built up altars to other gods, even worshipped other gods. And it always adds, especially when it said he did evil in the eyes of the Lord, it always adds, and caused Israel to sin. So wherever the king would go, more often than not, the people would go. So the choices the king made were almost always intimately connected with the choices of the people, with some rare exceptions, and we'll talk about that before we finish here this morning. But sadly, the vast majority of kings did evil in the eyes of the Lord. In fact, all of the kings of the northern kingdom, and today we're going to look at a king of the northern kingdom, all of them, without exception, did evil in the eyes of the Lord. Some of them were particularly bad, like the one that we're going to look at today, named Ahab. Now look at what it says of Ahab in 1 Kings chapter 21. It said, there was never anyone like Ahab who sold himself to do evil in the eyes of the Lord, urged on by Jezebel, his wife. He behaved in the vilest manner, going after idols, like the Amorites the Lord had drove out before Israel so many generations before. So this guy was bad. This guy was bad. Maybe the worst, though, I think there's one who's worse, and Pastor Cindy is going to talk about him next week. But even though he's so bad, I think the narrative surrounding Ahab's life can be instructive for us as we consider this question about choosing our object of worship. In Ahab's case, he had a choice between worshiping Baal, the charioteer of the clouds, or Yahweh, the charioteer of the clouds. How does one choose? How does one choose? Well, one thing is clear, and God warned of this when he warned his people when they were coming into the promised land, not to marry foreign wives. Okay? Now, don't mistake this for God being xenophobic. He loved the people of all nations. The problem that God rightly anticipated was that foreign people, particularly these foreign wives, would come in and they would influence their husbands, because let's be honest, we know that wives are pretty influential in the lives of their husbands, maybe even more influential than their husbands, and so they come in and they lead their husbands astray to worship other gods, to worship their gods that they brought from their own homelands. But why? I mean, Ahab still had a choice. He married this, what the Bible presents as a horrific woman named Jezebel. But he still had a choice. Was he not the king? Why is it that Ahab chose Baal instead of Yahweh? So I think that the answer to this question hits a bit closer to home than we might think. In 2 Chronicles chapter 18, we see part of the narrative of Ahab here. And in this chapter, there is an alliance between Ahab, the king of the northern kingdom of Israel, and Jehoshaphat, the king of the southern kingdom of Judah. So they're both children of Abraham, right? They both come from that same genealogy. But remember, we talked about last week, the kingdom split, and now they're both. But now they have an alliance that they've made between the two of them. And it's an amazing moment where we see these two kings coming together, one from each of the divided kingdom of Israel, coming together. And it's particularly interesting because Jehoshaphat was a faithful worshiper of Yahweh. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord. So we've got one king who chose to worship Yahweh, and we have one king who chose to worship Baal. And in 2 Chronicles 18, we have this remarkable interaction between the two of them. Let me just set it up for you briefly. They have a common enemy. And so they're coming together to decide, are we going to go together with each other to fight against this common enemy? And Jehoshaphat replies, it says, I am as you are, and my people are as your people. In other words, he's saying, we're both children of Abraham. Let's do this together. Let's be together. We don't need to fight. Let's join together in this. And he says, we will join you in the war. But Jehoshaphat also said to the king of Israel, that is Ahab, first seek the counsel of the Lord. Now, I love the bold confidence of Jehoshaphat here. He is the king. He's sitting across the table from another king, but he has the boldness and the humility to acknowledge that there is another king in the room, a more important king, a king above all kings that needs to be consulted first before they make a big decision like going to war. And Jehoshaphat is allegiant to Yahweh, and he says, well, okay, before we make this big decision, let's make sure we consult the Lord together. But look at what happens here, and it might easily be missed if you're just reading through. Jehoshaphat is expecting that his counterpart, King Ahab, will call in a prophet of Yahweh. But that's not what happens. Look at verse 5. It says, so the king of Israel, Ahab, he brought together the prophets, 400 men, and asked them, shall we go to war against Ramoth-Gilead, or shall I not? And this is what the prophets said. They said, go, they answered, for God will give it into the king's hands. Now, here's what might be easy for us to miss. These are not prophets of Yahweh. These are prophets of Baal. And they give Ahab the answer he wants to hear. Go to war and you're going to win. Right? But Jehoshaphat is a bit alarmed when he sees this happen here because Ahab is not consulting the Lord, he's consulting Baal. Now look at what it says in verse 6. This is what Jehoshaphat says. Is there no longer a prophet of Yahweh here who we can inquire of? And this here, in this verse that we see next, is what I really want us to pay attention to. Verse 7. Ahab answered Jehoshaphat, there's still one prophet of the Lord that we can inquire of Yahweh, but I hate him because he never prophesies anything good about me, but always bad. He is Micaiah, son of Imlah. I think this verse is so powerfully raw and true and instructive for us. I don't want us to miss it. I asked a few minutes ago, how did the ancient kings choose their gods? And I think here we see in Ahab a frank reality of how they chose their gods. Ahab chose the God who would give to him what he wanted to hear. If Baal is promised to be the bringer of rain, the charioteer of the clouds, and Yahweh is promised to be the bringer of rain, the charioteer of the clouds. And see, well, they both seem kind of like the same thing. How does he make this choice? Well, Ahab can choose the actual God who made the heavens and the earth and separated the sea from the sky and can actually bring rain, but who also demands allegiance from him and asks that he submit himself to his ways and to his rule, that he might teach him his ways, as we just sang about. The God whose prophets will speak hard truth, not easy lies. Or he can choose the other God. He can choose Baal. Ahab can choose the fake God that he can control, who's not going to tell him what to do, whose prophets will tell him what he wants to hear. Something about that hits a bit too close to home for me. I don't know about you. But when I'm operating as the ultimate authority over my life, the last thing I want is anyone else telling me what's right and what's wrong, what I should do and what I shouldn't do. I want to do what I want to do. I don't want a God who tells me that I keep too much of my money and don't give enough away. I don't want a God who tells me that I'm too quiet when injustices abound in the world. I don't want a God who calls me out of a life of comfort into a life of self-denial and sacrifice. I don't want a God who calls me out of my indulgences into a life of restraint and self-control. But if I'm the king, then I don't have to submit myself to anyone else's reign or rule over me. I can submit myself to any number of other gods who are great at telling me exactly what I want to hear, just like Baal and Ahab. I can bow at the altar of my appetites. I can bow at the altar of my hopes and my dreams. I can bow at the altar of my bank account. I can bow at the altar of my lust, at the altar of my loneliness, at the altar of my politics, at the altar of my own truth. I can live my own truth, as we talked about last week. The list can go on and on and on. We aren't that different from Ahab, after all. Baal was the charioteer of the clouds. But that was just a cover, wasn't it? Baal was just a cover for a selfish king who wanted to do what he wanted to do and didn't want anybody else to tell him that he couldn't do what he wanted to do. God, Yahweh, is the true charioteer of the clouds. God is the bringer of rain. And of course, if you know the story of Elijah, and if you don't, it's okay. I'm going to summarize it a little bit here. You know, as the kings were becoming more and more evil, this began what we call the time of the prophets. And so there started coming into Israel these prophets that were sent by God to speak into the brokenness and the evil realities that were happening because of these evil kings. And the greatest of all these prophets was the prophet Elijah. And he came, and there's this beautiful illustration of what happens with Elijah and Ahab. So there's a showdown between Ahab's prophets, the prophets of Baal, and Elijah and Yahweh. So who's it going to be, Baal or Yahweh? Who is going to bring, which God is going to bring the rain back? And so Elijah asked this very fundamental, same question that I've been asking this morning of myself and of all of you. Which God are you going to choose? And so Elijah asked this question, not to the king. He already has the answer from the king. Ahab is flatly rejecting God and choosing Baal, choosing himself, really, right? But so Elijah turns the question on the people and says, how long will you, people of Israel, waver between two opinions? If the Lord is God, that is, if Yahweh is God, follow him. But if Baal is God, then follow him. And the response must be so discouraging to Elijah. The people said nothing, it says. Crickets, right? They don't have an answer to the question, which God are you going to follow? So Elijah sets up this contest, Elijah and Yahweh, against the 450 prophets of Baal. Whichever God consumes the altar with fire from heaven is the real God. And those Baal prophets, well, man, they pray and they beg and they dance and they cut themselves and they scream to Baal, who, of course, can't hear them at all. It's an amazing story. I encourage you to read the whole thing in 1 Kings chapter 18. But the long story short is this. God wins. Big time. God wins. It's like, okay, we sang it earlier this morning. When we fight on our knees. That's exactly what Elijah was doing. He's just down on his knees praying, God, come. And then, bam, the fire of heaven comes down. He won that battle on his knees. Fire comes down from heaven, consumes the sacrifice, and the entire altar just gone. Fire from heaven. 1 Kings 18:39 says, when the people saw this, they fell prostrate. So bam, they fall on their face because they're so humbled and ashamed of their own sin, their own rejection of Yahweh. And now they fall in humility and they just cry, Yahweh, he is God. Yahweh, he is God. There's your answer. How do we choose which God? Which God is the one who brings the rain? Yahweh, he is God. I just saw what I know I saw. Yahweh, he is God. It's a beautiful moment. And then Elijah sends the people off to defeat the prophets of Baal. But it's what happens next that I love so much. The contest is won. The contest is over. But Elijah wants to know, is the rain coming? Is the rain still coming? Will God not only show himself to be God, but will he show himself to be good? Will he send the rain that the people so desperately need? Will Yahweh open up the floodgates of heaven, just like he promised King Solomon he would do if the people would humble themselves before him? Will Yahweh be the God that Baal never could be? And so we see this play out now. I want you to picture, this is towards the end of chapter 18 in 1 Kings. Elijah runs up to the top of Mount Carmel, and he bent down to the ground and put his face between his knees. So I don't know if you can see me up here. This is basically what he's doing. He's doing this. He's like, and he's just wondering to himself, oh my goodness, oh my goodness, what's going to happen? Is God going to send rain? Is God going to send rain? He calls the servant over. He says, go, look off in the distance, look towards the sea, and tell me what you see. And his servant says, there's nothing. Nothing. And I wonder what Elijah's feeling in that moment. He's like, ah, nothing? What? He says, go back and check. Go back and check. His servant goes out, looks towards the sea, comes back. There's nothing. Nothing. Okay. Check again. Check again. He goes back. He looks. Seven times he goes back. Finally, the seventh time, the servant comes back and reports just this tiny little cloud. He says, a cloud as small as a man's hand is rising from the sea. Cloud. Can you picture that? Looking off in the distance, all blue sky, but this tiny little cloud just forming over the sea, many miles away. That tiny little cloud, let me tell you, is such an important, such a powerful image. That is the image that the Lord is coming. Yahweh is coming. Yahweh is the true charioteer of the clouds. Who makes it rain? Yahweh makes it rain. And so he's coming on his chariots, on a cloud. He's the true giver, the true sustainer of life. And that wisp of cloud soon turned into a deluge of life-giving rain. It says in verse 45, the sky grew black with clouds. The wind rose. A heavy rain started falling, and Ahab rode off to Jezreel. That's where he lived. So Ahab is like riding off in defeat. Now, if we're playing teams here, right? Team Yahweh versus Team Baal, Team Elijah versus Team Ahab, then we're probably hoping like, hey, Team Ahab is gone. Like, that's the last we're going to see of Ahab, riding off in defeat to his tyrant wife, Queen Jezebel. But in fact, that's not the last that we see of King Ahab. He has more evil to do. He makes Elijah's life even more miserable. He has more injustices to level against the people. He really is the worst, the worst. But I might remind you that I am, speak for myself, a lot more like Ahab than we might like to admit. In the lifelong rule and reign that we have over our own lives, too often there's precious little time that we give full, humble allegiance to Yahweh. We may not be worshipers of Baal. We may not have golden idols in our houses of worship, but we have idols just the same. Pastor Louis Giglio, who was very influential in my life many years ago, he puts it this way. He said, if you want to know the idols of your life, follow the trail of your time, follow the trail of your money, Follow the trail of your affections. Follow the trail of your allegiances. And at the end of those various trails, you're going to find a throne. And whatever or whoever is seated on that throne is the object of your worship. We are not so unlike Ahab as we might hope. But there's a beautiful glimmer of hope in King Ahab's story that we shouldn't miss. So after committing all of the broken things in his life, towards the end of his life, he committed a vile act of greed and injustice against his neighbor named Naboth. And Elijah came and severely admonished Ahab. And the Lord promised, after Ahab had committed this sin, it was like the straw that broke the camel's back. The Lord promised to remove the rule of Israel from his family. And by the way, if you read it, there's more details there than just that. It's actually a bit graphic. It's super gory. And maybe that'll be the teaser you need, people who like that kind of thing. You're like, oh, interesting, gory? Let me read the Bible more. But it gets nasty. All right, and I'm not going to get into that, but the shocking and hopeful end to Ahab's story is this, if we can imagine any hope coming out of this. It's the way Ahab finally responds. Look at this. And really, these might be the most important verses that we often overlook. So often we talk about what Elijah did at Mount Carmel and all this other stuff that Ahab did, and it was like, oh, he's so evil. But these might be the most important verses in the entire Ahab narrative in 1 Kings. This comes from chapter 21 at the very end, 27 through 29. It says, when Ahab heard these words, that is like the prophetic words, the hard words of Elijah. And remember, he's been ignoring hard words his entire life. But this time is different. When he heard these words, he tore his clothes. He put on sackcloth and fasted and lay in sackcloth and went around meekly. And I love even the juxtaposition of him going around meekly to what happened even earlier in this chapter when he's walking around and he's moping and he's sad and he's crying because he's not getting what he wants. Now we see a very different Ahab. He goes around meekly, it says. Then the word of the Lord came to Elijah. And I love this. It's like God is noticing Ahab. God notices us, by the way. We know that. Like God's paying attention. He knows. He sees what's happening in our lives. When we turn away and when we turn toward God. And look at what God notices in his life. Verse 29. Have you noticed, he says to Elijah, have you noticed how Ahab has humbled himself before me? Because he has humbled himself, I will not bring this disaster in his day, that is in his lifetime, but I will bring it on his house in the days of his son. And that's a whole other can of worms right there. But this is remarkable. I never cease to be amazed by the mercy of our God. Here is a man whose whole life he chose Baal over Yahweh. He is whined and cried whenever he didn't get his way, to say nothing of the injustices that he committed against the people of Israel, the poor, the broken, the people he led astray, and any other number of untold pagan sacrifices that he participated in that were awful. And yet, here is Yahweh at the end, graciously showing King Ahab mercy when Ahab finally turns toward the Lord and humbles himself. Man, that is a God whose mercy extends 1,000 generations and whose vengeance only extends to the 3rd and 4th generation. Like 1,000 generations, 3rd and 4th generation. God's mercy outweighs his justice. I mean, we want our God to be a just God, believe me, but that's good news for all of us. God's mercy is so great. This is a God who is slow to anger and abounding in love. If God can show mercy and love to an Ahab, surely he can show love and mercy to any of us today and anybody outside of the space today. The question is not, can God do it? God can and will do it. The question is, will we have knees that will bend to God? Mike, you guys. Will we have knees that will bend? Not like 10 years from now when, you know, we've kind of done the things that we want to do and then we're like, oh, you know, then later on I'll be able to turn towards God. Not like on our deathbed, like we might read the story about Ahab and be like, oh, great, it worked for Ahab. He turned towards God at the very end and it worked out for him. Like, no. Like, we have a choice today and every moment of every day, will we bend the knees of our heart towards our God? When the prophet Elijah was in his darkest moments, he was wondering to himself, is there anybody, is there anyone who's going to bend their knees to our God? Or is everybody sold out for Baal? And I love, this is one of my favorite moments, that God says to him in that moment, I have reserved 7,000 in Israel, all whose knees have not bowed down to Baal and whose mouths have not kissed him. And so my hope for each of you kings and queens of your lives, my hope for each of you is that we might be counted among those whose knees will bow to God alone. Not knees that bow to our own whims and our own fancies, the things that we want, the things that we desire, but to God alone. Yahweh is the rainmaker. Yahweh is the giver of life. There is no other path that can lead to life. And Jesus came and he promised us this. He said, I am the way. I am the truth. I am the life. Choose me, he said. And our God freely gives himself, his mercy, his grace, his love to the humble of heart. Even Ahab. And so, we're just going to take the next few moments to sing this song. And my prayer is the prayer of this song is that we would have eyes to see our world the way God sees it. That our knees might bend the way that they're supposed to, that we might have proper perspective. Not to see all the charms of this world that we think are so worthy, but to say, oh wow, there is a king who is so much more worthy than any of those things. Heavenly Father, as we come before you, give us that vision, we pray. Show us your ways. May we not heed and choose riches, but may we choose you. May we not bow to so many other seemingly worthy things of our lives and in our lives, but may we bow to the high King of heaven, whose victory was won on Mount Carmel, whose victory was won on Mount Calvary, and whose victory is here with us today. Thank you, Lord. Amen.